Thank you for listening to the Data Is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion, with your host, Dapper Data.
What's up, what's up, what's up, everybody? You are listening to the Data Is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion. I am your host, Dapper Data. I have a very special guest on the call right now, okay? You have to tune into this, right? It's going to be short, but it's going to be concise, and it's going to be sweet, all right? But we're going to get right to the point, and we're going to talk about something very, very interesting, right? All my data scientists out there, right, when you are looking at algorithms, right, and you're thinking, man, there's a bias in this algorithm, right? Is it really the algorithm, or is it the data that's being presented to the algorithm? You know, there's so many thoughts out there, right? As far as data bias, right? Bias in statistics, right, is a big thing, right? Statistical bias and is a term used to describe statistics that don't provide an accurate representation of population. And so there's bias everywhere, right? And with data science being so prominent, being so dominant in the industries now, I think that this is a perfect time to talk about data bias. So I brought on the podcast Pierre Brunel. Thank you for joining, Pierre.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah, so thank you, Pierre, because we need somebody here to talk about this bias thing, right?
I'm going to resolve everything. I'm going to solve it for once, you know. And now it's a big topic, and I'm pretty excited to speak about that.
Yeah. It is, man. So Pierre is the CEO and co-founder of Notable. We're going to talk a little bit about Notable too, a collaborative notebook platform that enables teams to use and visualize data together. Having led Amazon, right? Amazon, the big cloud provider, Amazon's notebook initiatives, and worked on open source collaboration between Amazon and UC Berkeley, Pierre is dedicated to elevating the data collaboration space, which I think is a huge thing right now, because a lot of times people are talking about data platforms, right? They're talking about edge, the core to cloud. They're talking about how data is transitioning all these different places, but they're not talking about how we're collaborating and sharing the data across board, right? You know, and that can get missed. That's something that really could get skipped over a lot of times, you know. So Pierre is definitely here to talk about all those things. Thank you, Pierre. Tell them a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my background, you know, is very, very unique. I'm a structural engineer at first, and also a decision scientist, which is more about cognitive biases, which is really, you know, what we want to discuss about as well. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up in data, actually. And now I ended up, you know, being a product manager for Amazon, launching new businesses in Europe, and moving to the US 4 or 5 years ago. I still have a very strong French accent, but trying to get rid of it. I worked on a data platform at Amazon. I worked on machine learning products. We work on data quality packages as well. We have a data quality package that's open source. That's called DQ. That's working on top of Spark. That's used by Indeed, by Google, by all the company I speak with right now who are using Spark. And Scala, you know, I've been using that data quality package that we open source, and the team that you worked with in Berlin 3 years ago. So all of that, I think, led me to continue thinking about biases and decision-making and collaboration. And I think collaboration, which is why we built Notable, is the great way to solve some of those biases, because you bring different perspectives together and you can kind of analyze better and generate better insights that you feel like have kind of a notion of truth, because you bring different perspectives. So I'm really excited about talking about biases, collaboration, and of course what we do with Notable.
Oh, thank you, Pierre. I appreciate it. So tell us, let's talk about Notable, right? Let's take a step back before we get into the biases. Let's talk about Notable, right? What is Notable, and how are you using that to help out the world today?
Yeah, there are many aspects of it. It's a very complex platform, and you know, depending on who I'm talking to, I have many different ways to describe it. I think I love analogies. I think analogies is a great way to describe things. So think about Google Doc when you can write code and make visualization. I think it's the best way to describe it from a very, very high level. You join the platform, we solve three main pain points. The first pain point for people to work with data is how you access data. Mm-hmm. So we make it easy to access data from local files to data warehouses to any API. So solved, you know, you come into Notable and you connect any data you want and you wrangle it together. Mm-hmm. Second pain point you want to solve for any type of data teams out there is access to hardware and compute. We make it easy to connect to CPU, to GPUs, or to sit on top of, you know, the solution that help you scale, such as Databricks or Dask or all those kind of GPU and NVIDIA solutions. So we can sit on top of that. And once you have solved accessing data and access to hardware and compute for kind of all the different roles within the data teams, they need to be able to get the work done. And how do they do that? Python, SQL, R, and no code. So it's really about, at the end of the day, bring all your team together within one platform for 90% of your use cases and let them work with the data the way they want, with the data that they want. And that's really what we do. And the outcome of what people use Notable for are usually in three buckets that I like to categorize. A lot of ad hoc analysis that becomes, you know, knowledge and wisdom that can be propagated within a company that other can reuse and easily know, you know, not have to start from scratch, but start from templates. It's like, oh, here's the complex SQL queries, here's the complex Python pipeline that I can just, I don't know how to code it myself, but now that it's there, I kind of fine tune it to understand what happened and change some parameters and make it my own. That's the first one. Mm-hmm. The second one is really the dashboard and interactive data apps use case. You know, everyone talked about data apps and interactive dashboard. And the third one is the pure machine learning kind of use case that what notebooks have been good for the past, you know, 10 years. And this is why Jupyter Notebooks is the most used tool among the data scientist communities, because it is the tool of choice for reactive computing and really being able to build those building blocks to create machine learning models that you can train and then share with others to kind of make a decision about, do we put that into production? Do we rely on that insight to make a decision? So that's kind of why Notable is, it's kind of a big package of how to bring data together, people together, and hardware together at the end of the day.
No, it's sweet, man. It's sweet because if you think about it, like, say you're a coder, I'm a coder, we work for a company, right? From my understanding, based off of Notable, we're able to kind of work on the same, I guess, notebook, essentially, at the same time. Could you essentially say, like, wait, maybe I'm good at, like, Python and you're good at, like, Scala or something like that? You know, could we still collaborate?
Yeah, you could, you know, I could write the PySpark aspect of it. You could write the Python aspect of it. Someone wants to chime in and write the complex subqueries for SQL against Snowflake to bring the data in the memory.
Yeah.
Let's have the data engineer write the first two cells about the SQL statement. Or worst case, they write it in another notebook, and then we source our notebook from their notebook. You know, there's like so many ways to... It's actually very difficult sometimes to come in into a company and say, because I know everything you can do with it. It's so flexible in terms of accessing all the API. Because the power of it at the end of the day, it's a coding platform.
Yeah.
So there's no limit into the APIs, the SDKs, the mix between Python and SQL and R that you can bring together. People are so used to, I'm not going to mention names, you know, but they are so used to having tools that are purely no code at first and stuck with like boxes and say, oh, if the data is not already available to me, I cannot do it. Oh, if that doesn't, there is not a native data connector for it, I cannot do it. Like the fact of being a coding platform first and building UX and UI an entry point for different personas, like no code for data analytics, plugging to orchestration platform and ETL pipeline for data engineers, you know, or connecting to a Git repo if you want to work with Git. It's really like trying to solve the biggest problem out there, which is you have a data team, you have people on all the spectrum from the least technical to the data scientist with the Superman of data, you know? And the more technical person was, or the most technical person was like machine learning engineer, data engineer. Mm-hmm. And how can they have a tool like marketing and sales and PM person have Google Doc to work together to actually go get to the insight faster and make decision faster?
Man, this is amazing. I mean, you really are allowing, it doesn't matter the size of the company. It doesn't matter the distance, right? How far they are, you know, and this is even better, right? For people that are like teleworking, right? You know, these days, because a lot of developers are doing that, right? Even the government, now they're going into more teleworking, being virtual meetings and things like that. So developers that are virtual now, you know, they're able to now share data across the board. So, you know, definitely check out Notable, everybody. Is Notable the only product within Notable, or are there other products, you know, other use cases that you want to highlight?
No, Notable is the main product. We have been out there for 3 years now. So our notebook platform is, you know, what we provide, and then we plug with your data stack. So very flexible in the way we deploy as well. We can deploy, you know, single tenants or within your VPC, or you can use our multi-tenant for free that's available at app.notable.io, or you can find it from our website and sign up. It's completely free. We have a lot of researchers and students as well using our platform, and we provide like small instance of CPUs unlimited for free to help them kind of do their research as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Pierre. I mean, definitely check out Notable. I recommend it. You know, I'm definitely going to check it out myself and maybe collab and try to use it for internal uses for my company that I have. So thank you, Pierre, for that. Now let's get into the bias conversation, right? I mean, this is the conversation that it probably can last way longer than this podcast, I'm sure. But you know, we have to keep it concise. But recognizing data biases, right, and how they impact the way data is presented and utilized, that's something that's very important, especially with data science these days, data analysis these days. You know, when you're getting these data sets, right, how do you know, man, that they're whether they're biased data sets or not? You know, I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
You really picked the worst topic. It's a fantastic topic. I feel like it's difficult to be right. For me, there are many aspects of it. From a data perspective, there is a reason why lineage and traceability is a big topic. I was actually going to write something about explainability again. Explainability was a big topic 4 or 5 years ago. And it's becoming a big topic again because of generative AI and ChatGPT. And you know, when machine learning was finally used for powering decision-making at companies and you automate process, like, you know, when I was working at Amazon and we automate forecasting or pricing, we automate like customer reviews, stuff that I cannot really speak about, but
right.
The machine makes decision at the end of the day. You know, you to dumb, let's dumb out, you know, machine learning for a second. You look at the pattern, you automate a rule, you put that rule in production that is machine learning based. And you say, now when there is any input coming in, make the decision and here's the output. And it can be a change in pricing, can be showcasing similar products that you want to buy, can be a color change on the button, like can be anything. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people ask about explainability because they're like, how do we know that's the right decision to make?
Yeah, how do you trust it?
Yeah, where is that decision coming from and why did we make the decision? So many aspects to it. One, Notable. I was not planning to sell about that, but why notebook was so powerful and is powerful within the data science community is because by the nature of a notebook, which is a document, you create building blocks and you see how the insight is being generated. So you see where the data is coming from. If you run a SQL against your Snowflake, you see what model in Python you use to train your model and generate the prediction. So you see the parameters you used, you see the tables, all the columns you put aside, you see the variance. You know, you can showcase step by step what decision you made to get to the final prediction and get the accuracy or predictability or whatsoever. So I think the tool in itself, that's why it was so powerful to help in explaining the making of a machine learning model. Now, I think there is another aspect, which is data management and data catalog. This is why the lineage and the data catalog solution kind of exploded as well, because it's very insightful to be able to know where the data is coming from, where it's been aggregated. When you look at clickstream data, which is web traffic data, it's very difficult to trust. You know, the first thing I say is when you think about bias and data, and is data is not objective. Like it's not like it's my take, but data is not objective. Data is subjective. And what's the first element of that is we decide what kind of data we collect.
Whoa.
You come on Amazon.com. We decide to put a tag to collect the fact that you click on that button.
Mm-hmm.
And you click on the next button. And to aggregate data about your customer profile, your address. We decide to not collect data about some other aspect of it. So just the data that we decide to collect and data that we decide not to collect, it's maybe available for us to grab if we want it,
mm-hmm.
but that's subjective. So just relying on the dashboard, you know, someone told me that, I'm not going to mention name again, but a long time ago, like a leader told me, hey, let's not like discuss that. The data is objective. And I was like, this is the most bullshit statement I've ever seen. The data is objective. I decided to show you this metric. I decided to compute that KPI this way with this formula. I decided to conditional format the table in red and green to make you, to use your bias to because you don't like green and you like red. I decided to go to give you three options with one that was bad. You know, like there's so many cognitive biases in you making the decision in the data itself that it's impossible for me to say at first data is objective.
So it's almost like how do you solve that problem, right? Because from my understanding, what you're saying is basically we're looking at traceability, right? Like tracing it back to the domain owner, right? The person that is actually feeding that data into the system. I always say that it's the data that's biased. So it's the person that is actually collecting this data, right? If I created an Excel spreadsheet, I want these columns, these rows and stuff like that. You know, I'm almost the person that can be deemed the bias or not individual. I mean, do you solve it with in an organization? Would I make sure that there is different cultures, right, that are doing it, right? You know, I mean, is that one way to do it? I mean, are there other ways to even like solve that bias problem?
I mean, you cannot solve it because we all have it. I think, like you said, in every field, there is research proving that having different mindset and different culture is the best way to be the most productive. Just paired, you know, there's about gender, about culture, background, about everything, about non-technical, non-scientifical, technical, artistic, whatever. Like bringing a very, let's say, variety of people with different background all together for your data project is actually the best way to get to the best insight. And the categorizing best as what is your optimization target? I don't know. It's like, is it making money? Is it increasing your revenue? I don't know. But it's proven in every field. I think going back to the source is very important, like you said, with the source of the data. And then you let people make the judgment call. You know, I was asking ChatGPT some data about, I was writing an analysis for Valentine's Day like last week. And there's not a lot of data when you look at this, you know, kind of thing. There's just a bunch of surveys. And surveys is a big one for biases because what is significance for qualitative research? You know, oh, it's thousands of people with blah, blah, blah. It's like, and you read the surveys like 80% of Americans do not buy chocolate for Valentine's Day. And then the survey says like, we interview 1,000 people in Texas. It's like, okay, that's American. And yeah, it's research proven, like there's significance in that and there's some variance and whatever. So people trust that. It's funny when you listen to polls online. And I look at that and I was like, okay, maybe I'm going to ask ChatGPT what they think about it. Because I was writing that analysis for Valentine's Day and the survey was showing that men buy more jewelry at Valentine's Day than other, you know, the rest of the year. And ChatGPT was saying, oh, women represent 80% of the people who are buying jewelry during, you know, normally. And I was like, okay, it's normal. Maybe Valentine's Day, men are being asked to buy jewelry for women. So that's why. And ChatGPT was quoting the sources. It was like, based on the source from survey by McKinsey in 2018, made in China, whatever. And I was like, oh, this is the best way to actually uncover some biases is going back to track lineage and the sources. I was able to say, okay, now I use my critical thinking. Do I rely on that data to draw a conclusion or make an assumption about it? Mm-hmm. And I can because it was a data from McKinsey. Do I trust McKinsey as a brand? Kind of, that they do, you know, surveys the right way. It was in 2018. So is it like an up-to-date information? Maybe not. It was in China. So what's the difference between China and the US and me doing an analysis only for the US? But I think going back to the sources, how the data was collected, if it's from Clickstream and a tag on your JavaScript or a survey, and was it a multi-choice question or was it like a binary question? All of that influenced the results. And I think it's very important for people to be aware of that, how the data was collected in the first place and where it's coming from.
No, that's awesome because like what you have honed in on is, you know, even though you have things like ChatGPT, right? You know, you almost have to still be that authoritative person, you know, to finalize. Like, you don't just trust the data that's presented, right? You know, you have to still do your own fact checking afterwards, but it's a good source maybe to give you a little bit of advice. And then after that, you say, okay, let me, it's like the government, right? You have multiple contractors, you're asking, you know, their opinions on things, but you have to push the final button. So if you're the person that's going to make the final decision, don't just trust ChatGPT maybe, you know what I mean? Is that what you're thinking?
At the end of the day, you know, it's like I told you, I like analogies. So let's make another analogy and talk about maybe away from bias for a second, more like because at the end of the day, what people care about, who is responsible for the decision?
Right, right.
Whether accountability. And there's that whole topic with self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. If you have an accident, is it Tesla who is responsible for crashing the car? If people...
I know who's responsible.
Is it AWS server who crashed at the minute when he was computing the data? Or, you know, like, I don't know. Imagine the future when is electrical grid going down and we are relying on, like, you know, electric road, you know, highways. And I don't know. Like, it's very, is it at the end the person who is in charge to make the decision, the driver, the person clicking on generating that Tableau report, or that notable dashboard? Or is it the person making a decision, the CEO, who is legally on paper signed a contract saying he is responsible?
Right.
It's a difficult one. But I think going back to bias, the thing I really focus on is my statement that data is not objective because you decide where and how you collect it. So go back to the source, detail the process step by step, how you go from data to KPI to a metric to insight, to knowledge, to wisdom, and document that will process step by step. And that can just be a Google Doc, that can be a notable notebook, that can be a complex feature store for machine learning, or, you know, a data catalog solution for your metric store. Like, it takes different shape and form depending on what data project we are talking about. But that lineage tracking aspect of it is the most important.
No, thank you for that. You know, so I appreciate you being on the podcast. You have really dropped a lot of cool gems. I think that the audience is going to really understand. They'll do a lot more fact checking. I'll say that, you know.
They can fact check me. I don't know if I was right in everything I said, but that's my biased opinion.
Right, you have to do it, right? I mean, customer, you know, I mean, you think about Amazon, right? Amazon always, they're really good at like focusing on customers, right? You know, and they're like, man, I can, because you have done XYZ, I know that you may possibly like this other stuff, right? You know, and even though you may like it and it might intrigue you, if you're trying to search for maybe a table for your kitchen and you're looking at your table, you still want to, even if you have those customer reviews out there, you got Amazon recommended and all that stuff, you still want to go back and research it yourself, right? You know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
ChatGPT, right? I mean, you know, I looked up stuff and I said, man, do I even need to understand Python anymore? I mean, did I do all this work for nothing, you know? And one thing I realized that ChatGPT did not specifically handle, and maybe it will in the future, is if I work for like Bloomberg or some company that nobody knew about, right? And I needed to understand how to do something specific to that company, you know, ChatGPT might not have the specific answer for you, right? And but it can give you an overview and you keep diving into it and you can keep searching and do your own research. But I think doing your own research is it's going to be a thing forever, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, ChatGPT is wrong about prime numbers. So just the way, you know, you ask, go ask ChatGPT about prime numbers and will be wrong. I don't know where the data is coming from to source that, but you ask ChatGPT, I think, about is 79 a prime number or whatever, and it's saying no when it's actually a prime number.
Oh, and, man.
And you Google it and you say 79 a prime number and says yes. So yeah, I think they're going to come up with confidence level now to be able to like help people, because in Notable, we didn't do it yet, but like we are thinking about it. The thing is, we don't want to give people the wrong insight or the wrong queries, but there are a lot of people trying to rely on ChatGPT or OpenAI or GPT or whatever other kind of generative AI models to help code and help you in coding. And like suggest SQL statements, suggest Python statement, and suggest like improvements of your code. You know, Copilot has been doing it with GitHub for a while, and that's good at certain things, but they are wrong at a lot of things because they are trying to infer new data sometimes, and like data doesn't exist. So like, why are you trying to make me query something that doesn't exist? But they are still better at coding than they will be at having thoughts or like generate things in the open world, because coding is a very, for a machine, writing code is way simpler than just thinking about an open world. So that's why I think it's a use case that's actually good for being having a machine in the loop. We talked a lot about human in the loop in the past, which is how to improve machine learning with human in the loop. I think what's great is AI in the loop. Like, have AI in the loop in your coding. And that might help a lot with writing unit tests, for example. And that might accelerate a lot the work of an infrastructure team or DevOps team. Or I think AWS started using it for writing documentation on AWS services because, you know, you can scale the support team to write all the documentation. And I think ChatGPT is fantastic at summarizing thoughts, summarizing text. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when you ask ChatGPT something, it will all the time not have an opinion, just give you a summary. Right. And it's funny when you read a statement from ChatGPT, it always starts and finish, I feel like, the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it says right, maybe left, but maybe right.
Yeah.
And so that's when you read kind of the structure of the statement, it's always kind of in a similar way. It's like very, very like sandwich methods if you're giving feedback to someone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I like you, but I like you. So, yeah.
No, that's true. That's true. Well, thank you, Pierre. I appreciate you being on the podcast. As the audience know, I like to end with what I call a dope nugget or gem at the end of it. And what I've learned from this podcast is that traceability is a real thing. It's important, right? I mean, you think about if you're trying to sit there and make a decision. Actually, I'm working on this for my PhD right now as a data scientist. And something like the tools that venture capitalists use right now and angel investors use to make a decision on whether they want to give money or not, right, is based off of, is don't blame the tool they're using, right, but the data that's presented in there and being able to trace and say, look, why did it make the decision to choose this maybe ethnicity over this other, or this gender over another gender, right? You know, all that stuff matters, right? So being able to trace it back, right, is important. And if you can come up with something, a way to be able to trace it back, I think that would be more valuable than anything because of the way the transition is of data right now in this world. So data traceability is being the ability to ensure that the data is completely traceable across the entire landscape. And if you're able to do that, then it's amazing. It's an amazing thing that you're able to do. And so, Pierre, thank you for being on. Is there anything that you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah, I think that's the most important statement of our discussion is if you're on my side, believe that data is not objective, and you decide what you collect, you decide what you present, and you're responsible for making the decision. So try to be maybe not always data-driven, but data-informed. I think that's the most important. So I think I can leave the audience with that message. Be data informed, but not always just data driven, because you can make decisions pretty blindly if you just look at the data without your critical thinking.
No, that's excellent. You know, and I definitely agree with that I like it. I might even steal it and use it as a hashtag or something, you know, on social media. Be data informed. I love it, you know, instead of being data driven, you know.
As long as I get to the royalties, I'm good.
Yeah, you get it. You get it. So I want to play a game, right? The audience knows I love to play this game called Overrated, Underrated. And basically, I got the game from a motivational speaker of mine. His name was his name is Gary Vee. And basically, he is presented with a series of topics, right? 5 to 7 topics. And you get to decide whether you think it's overrated, underrated, or right where it needs to be. And the reason why we're doing this is because a lot of times the audience probably, they talk about us geeking out all the time. We're talking about Jupyter Notebook. We're talking about notebooks. We're talking about Python, R. They're like, what, you know, the novice audience, right? You know, and I love all of them. But sometimes they want to hear that we're normal, I guess, right?
What, we didn't sound normal during this? Yeah. Like, we're pretty normal.
All this crazy stuff at me, you know. Do you like popcorn, right? Do you like the Super Bowl, right? You know, what's your thoughts on that? So we do have opinions about those things. We just sleep, eat, and breathe our craft, you know, but we do have opinions about the other stuff. So are you ready to play the game?
I am ready as I can be.
Okay. First one is, wait, are you in Seattle right now?
I am in Seattle, yeah.
Okay. How long have you been there?
Getting on 5 years, I think.
Okay. All right. First one is the printer.
The printer. Definitely overrated.
Me too.
It's still the classic marketing trick of the printer is nearly free and you pay so much for the cartridge.
Yeah.
And it never works. And you try to look at the best printer you want to buy every year and none of them is rated well. It's like the printer business needs to change. I'm telling you. It's like, I don't know.
I'm going to leave, man. Why do I need a printer, man? And then you get those people that every once in a while they say, you have to print it out. And I'm like, oh my gosh, why would you do this to me?
I think Amazon is the one sustaining the printing business. I'm telling you why, because I don't know now, they're all remote. Oh, they're going back to work apparently, but the, you know, every meeting, you know, Amazon is famous for that PR FAQ kind of 6-pager.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to, when you write a doc, you write a 6-pager and then you all go in a giant meeting room. And you have to print, and you have to print for the number of people in the room. So I used when I wrote PR FAQs, which are just like 6-pager to explain why you want to do something in a very FAQ format, saying with the customers, what's the success criteria, what's the timeline, what's the launch, kind of go to market. And so if you have 12 people in the meeting, you print 6-page multiplied by 12, and then you throw it all of them in the trash.
My goodness, in the trash, I know.
Sometimes printing is good. I still like a book when I read. I'm not a Kindle person. My wife is a Kindle person. I am not. But yeah, definitely overrated. It needs a disruption.
Okay. All right. Starbucks.
Pretty. Yeah. About right.
About right.
It's expensive, but you know, love a good Starbucks when I'm on the road. I think it's always the go-to when you stop McDonald's or Starbucks. But when I go to McDonald's with my French accent, they never understand what I'm saying. My wife has a famous video of me trying to order coffee at the McDonald's, and I'm like, "Can I have a black coffee?" And I didn't know they don't do black coffee yet.
There's no coffee either.
Can I have a black coffee or dark coffee? I think I said black coffee. Can I have a black coffee? And they're like, "Oh, do you want a Coca-Cola?" And I was like. Yes, a Coca-Cola, whatever. And she said, okay, sparkling water. I was like, what are you talking about? So McDonald's is not on my list anymore. I was like so ashamed of myself in front of my wife. So Starbucks, they understand me, but I use Sam as a Starbucks name because Pierre, they never get it right. It's always like Pierre or whatever.
Yeah.
So I have Sam is my Starbucks name, but definitely right where, you know, pretty much right where it needs to be.
Okay. Yeah, I was never big on coffee, you know, as I've talked about before. Now, coffee, I might have been big on coffee if it wasn't for me being traumatized when I was younger, right? Well, my dad, he used to drink coffee all the time. And I remember I was like 8 years old and I decided to taste his coffee when he left, right? It was hot as crap, right? And it was just, it was black coffee, but it didn't have anything in it, right? And I tasted it and burned my tongue, right?
Oh,
and
my
I
God.
Spilled it all over the car and all that crap. And so I said, oh, this is the worst thing ever. So I never tasted this since then.
You know, So when I was structural engineer, I worked in Saudi Arabia for a bit in Jeddah. And we were drinking Turkish coffee.
Mm-hmm.
It's only if you're around the Turkish coffee, it's really intense.
Is it good?
It's intense. that's the best way to describe it. So if really want to, like, if you want to go back into coffee, don't start with Turkish coffee. But yeah, so
all right, yeah, hiking.
IKEA,
hiking.
I thought you said IKEA. Then we are continuing with brands. hiking. Ah, yeah, you really target me with Seattle, right? Starbucks in Seattle, hiking.
Oh yeah, yeah, man.
yeah. I don't know if you did that on purpose, but I did. So my official answer as an inhabitant of Seattle is I love hiking and I love outdoors. I'm not a fan of hiking. I would say overrated a tiny bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I love Seattle and being in the Pacific Northwest is big on hiking, like truly. As long as you don't mind the rain. So if you get used to the rain, you can hike a lot. It's not my thing. I'm too, it's like running. I'm more like a biker, a snowboarder, like fast paced sports. I'm too bored when I hike. I just like, what am I doing here? I'm like, I need to get out of here. But yeah, hiking in the park, just down there for 5 minutes. Sounds good. Walking the dog, but no more than that.
Yeah. All right. So look, hiking for me, I've probably done it like once or twice. For me, it's like, I did the Boy Scouts in the past, but maybe, that helped me like be familiar with the outdoors, but nah, I'm not really too big on it. I mean, maybe I want to get my kids out there, the boys or something, to do something, but you know, I'm not that big on it, you know, myself. You know?
Yeah. And I don't like doing loops. Like, why do you go from A to B and you come back in the same spot? Like, I just, what did you achieve? You know? No, I think it's good to go out there and change mindset. But yeah, not my kind of my go-to activity when I go outside. I'll do like paddleboarding, kayaking, biking, above hiking for sure.
All right, next one, cheese.
Oh, you picked a good one. So as you didn't guess, but maybe I'm French. And I do not like cheese. So that's a good one you picked. I think it's right where it needs to be. My friends make fun of me because actually I eat cheese only when it's on a pizza, when it's like mozzarella that's cooked. But if not, like just cheese in general, I'm just having a hard time. Like since I'm a kid, like you with your coffee story, I don't know what happened to me. Is it genetics or something? I just don't make me look at cheese. I would have a strong reaction. there is a different type of cheese, of course, but yeah, it's the right way it needs to be. I think cheese is fantastic, brings a lot of flavor to many things and useful in so many dishes, but I'm not the right person to comment on cheese.
Yeah, my wife is like crazy about cheese, man. I'm not a big cheese person. I like cheese on things, right? You know, like a hamburger, I might throw a cheese on it. That's cool, you know. But even then, it's like I'm not going out of my way to throw cheese on it. I don't hate it. I think it's a great additive, but I just don't go out of my way for it. You know?
No, my wife was just like, take an entire like Parmigiano block and just eat it like that.
Yeah. I'm like, how do you do that?
It's pure fat. She hates when I say that. It's just like, you know, it's pure fat you're eating right now. She's like, stop saying fat. It's disgusting.
All right. Two more things. Cardamom buns.
Yeah. I don't know. That's cardamom buns. I don't think I ever had one.
Oh, you haven't had one? Because that's a Swedish dish, right?
Did I have one?
Yeah, it was a Swedish dish that was out there, and I was like, man, I wonder if you've had it or not.
I don't think I had one. Maybe a long time ago. Cardamom. I would say maybe I eat once. I think I'm okay with that. I love everything that's like pâtisserie, viennoiserie, like
we like pastries.
Yeah, pastries. Yeah.
Okay, so pastries are big.
I'm being into pastries, like underrated. It's lovely pastries, like for brunch, for breakfast, even for the, you know, in France, we have the, you know, you eat late, you eat at 8 p.m. or 9 p.m.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because you eat, the tradition was that you eat every 4 hours.
Uh-huh.
So the tradition is you wake up, 8 p.m. breakfast, noon lunch, 4 p.m. we have the goûter, which is the second breakfast.
Uh-huh.
And 8 p.m. dinner. So it's every, it's a basically something every 4 hours.
Oh, 8, man. 12,
8, 12, 16, 20. So that's how we, so I used to have at 4 p.m. when you come back from school as a kid, you have a second breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of pastries and all that stuff. So loved it, still love it. It's, you know what I do, my secret. I'm gonna give you the audience a secret. It's not about
the
data.
Give us the secret.
You go to Costco. I'm advertising Costco if you have a Costco membership. You buy the 12 croissant.
Mm-hmm.
It's like $5. 12 is like nothing. You cut them in half, all of them. You put them in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you want a croissant every morning, not even croissant every morning, by the way. You take it, you put it in the toaster for like 1 minute and you eat it with some jam. It's like if it was just made yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep them in the freezer for like a month. All good. And I just got like 12 croissants for like $5.
Oh, man. And it lasts you that long.
Frozen? Like, yeah. No worries. Like months. All good. Try that and let me know. It's right. I think it's I told that to the most American person I know.
Uh-huh.
And he loved it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm definitely going to try that because you know, we have a large family, as I told you before. And so, you know, being able to spread that food across time, you know,
yeah,
we love bread, right? We love pastries and stuff.
Oh, so please try it. And you know, if you didn't like it, I refund you.
This is recorded, Pierre.
here's my phone number. No, but you have my email, so you send me a Venmo, and I will refund you the $6 croissant. I will even,
That's all right. Last one, Amazon.
Oh my gosh, I still have a lot of friends at Amazon. So, in terms of what, so many things to speak about.
Well, I was just thinking about you know, ordering packages on a regular basis, things like that. Just being a home person that just loves to shop and things like that, you know, is it overrated, underrated?
What
do you
think?
Not working there, of course.
I think
I don't want to get you in trouble.
Is it recording? I think it is. No, I think it's right when it needs to be without taking a stand. And I think, you know, there are so many fantastic things that Amazon is doing. And so many things that are difficult to understand for other people, or like that are failing because it's just the way it is. Like, you know, when you're a VC, you invest in startups, and startups mm-hmm. are successful 9 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a big company, when you launch your product, you are successful just 1 out of 10. You know, just the way it is. Sorry, I said 9 out of 10. It's the opposite. Just mm-hmm. 1 out of 10 of the companies are successful. And, you know, people saying Google is like, are failing all the time, blah, blah, blah. I mean, yes, what they do is Google Engine and you search and they try so many things. And, you know, Google X was famous for failing. Right. They did like a whole pitch about how do we fail great.
Yeah.
I was like, let me teach you how to fail because they failed so many times. But they did still Waymo and so many other projects. They have like an insurance company. So Amazon is doing something fantastic as a company is acquisition. They are fantastic at acquiring the right company and building businesses around them. I think they are fantastic at that. Like PillPack that they acquired when they had Amazon Care to like sell, you know, drugs and everything. They acquired Roomba lately, which I think makes a lot of sense if they continue investing like IoT with Roomba, the robots and stuff like that. Twitch is pretty successful when they acquired Twitch. Difficult to make. I have a lot of context about that. So. Difficult to, you know, bring it into the Prime ecosystem, but I think Twitch is a very successful company and continue to be successful. World Food acquisition has been fantastic. World Food, I think, is a great company as well. You know, like talking about the BI space, Salesforce, without commenting on it, they acquired Tableau, Slack. You can judge by yourself. It is difficult to acquire, to spend billions in a company and either grow the business at the way it was growing because it goes to a maturity level, or just finding synergies so the acquisition makes sense as part of your ecosystem to either expand your reach or creating, you know, one plus one equal three. You know, it's difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they failed at things. They are good at things. I've complained, though, lately the packages are not arriving on the same day, so they are missing.
But I think Prime, I got Prime and Prime Day, same day. I need it on the same day. They guaranteed this.
Do you buy on Amazon because it's arriving on the same day? That's a good question.
Oh, man. We get packages almost all the time. Every 4 days, man. Every 3 days.
What do you do with those recycling boxes? I don't know what to do with them.
With the boxes?
Yeah.
I just recycle them. I just throw them to recycle, and then I don't know what they do.
Like,
with
how many trash do you have? Like, I have one, and it's just so I always overpacked. And recycling in the US is another topic because, you know, what you think, yeah, is being recycled, but it's not.
I know, that's the thing. I don't know what's happening afterwards, but they say you got to recycle. You got your recycling, yeah. You have your trash. You know,
China used to buy 90% of it or something like that, of the plastic, and now it's not economical anymore. So they stopped buying it. So most of the recyclable plastic is actually in a field, in a landfill. So it's not really recycled. Oh. Yeah, it's pretty sad. It's just an economical value. And yeah, China used to be the most buyer of. You know, recycling product from the US, and it's not happening anymore. But that should be another podcast.
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing, man. I have to do some research on that. I didn't know
that. You should do a podcast and data about recycling.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Well, thank you, Pierre. I appreciate it. You know, audience, you know, this has been very insightful, Pierre. You have given a lot of knowledge to the audience. I appreciate you being on here. Thank you for listening to Data is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion. I'm your host, Dapper Data. Where can they reach you up here? And is there anything that you're promoting right now?
Notable.io. Go give it a shot. We have a free version for student researchers, small companies who want to play with it. Mostly medium and large companies, we provide custom deployments. But even, you know, if you are part of the data teams and complex data teams, come try it out, connect to your data or upload some data, play with it, give us some feedback, and jump on a call with me.
Yeah. Is there any conferences that you have going on that you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, we have PyCon coming up. Our VP of engineering, Carol Winning, very famous person out there, who contributed a lot to the Python community, is a keynote speaker, and she's a VP of engineering. And I'm pretty proud to have her in our team. And so I think it's 20 years of PyCon as well. So I think it's going to be big. It's in Salt Lake City. And we have JupyterCon in May, if I'm not mistaken, in Paris. So come say hi. We are sponsoring JupyterCon. We'll have a booth there. And it's always great to see what the community is doing around Jupyter Notebooks, which is really taking off because of the rise of Python. And I think all the companies like us, you know, we are trying to make it easy to use by anyone more than just data scientists.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Pierre, again. I appreciate it. This has been a great podcast. Audience, as you know, you can always reach me at Mr. Dapper Data on any one of the social media platforms. Definitely subscribe to my YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@DapperData. All right. Love you all. Peace. Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to the Data is My Science podcast, the show that makes data your passion, with your host, Dapper Data.